From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Next hour, the Alchemy of Nine Dimensions, the 2011-2012 prophecies with Barbara Hand Clow. Well, I trust your Memorial Day went well, and you took a few moments to reflect on our soldiers who gave their lives for all of us. We shall, in another moment or two, do that again. More problems for the Large Hadron Collider. It's recovering now from a general power cut, which affected the machine systems. The power was cut to the entire accelerator complex at CERN. The outage after was probably caused, they think, by storms. They say the proton beams should be back in the machine by Wednesday. The collider is currently in a technical stop to allow technicians access to the 27-kilometer-long tunnel housing the giant machine. So more problems there. After first saying that the extradition of UFO hacker Gary McKinnon would be stalled indefinitely, the new United Kingdom Prime Minister Cameron quickly backtracked and now claims that there's nothing he can do to forestall his extradition to the United States, where he could be tried as a terrorist and sentenced to years in prison. McKinnon claims that he was visiting into NASA computers to look for UFO evidence. McKinnon claims that he found evidence of the existence of deep space fleets that were being overseen by NASA, but was unable to obtain copies of the records that he saw. People who know him fear that if he is extradited, put in prison, that he could commit suicide. An unmanned Japanese spacecraft designed to return samples from an asteroid has completed a very important step on its journey back to Earth. Hayabusa achieved the second and largest of four engine firings designed to guide the probe back home. Now, the probe visited an asteroid in 2005, making close approaches designed to capture soil samples. But the mission has been plagued by technical glitches affecting the engines and communications with Earth. It remains unclear whether the probe managed to grab any material from the asteroid. Scientists will have to open up the capsule when it gets back here on June 13th to find out. And scientists and government officials say there's a disaster that we can't see in the Gulf of Mexico's mysterious depths. The ruin of a world inhabited by enormous whales, tiny invisible plankton. Researchers have said that they have found at least two massive underwater plumes of what appears to be oil, each hundreds of feet deep and stretching for miles. Yet the chief executive of BP, which has for weeks downplayed everything from the amount of oil spewing into the Gulf to the environmental impact, said there is no evidence that huge amounts of oil are suspended undersea. And the best hope for stopping the flow of oil from that blown-out well at the bottom of the Gulf has been compared to hitting a target the size of a dinner plate with a drill more than 2 miles into the earth. Effort after effort has failed to stop what has already become the nation's worst ever spill, and BP is readying another attempt as early as Wednesday now. This is called a cut-and-cap process to put a lid on the leaking wellhead so oil can be siphoned to the surface. As he's been watching all along for us, Captain Kelly Sweeney with us. Kelly, here we go again. I don't want to say we told them so, but nothing seems to be working.
You're right, George. Ahoy to you and all the listeners, and you're right that top kill didn't work, and this new procedure, which essentially is putting an umbrella, cutting the pipe, putting an umbrella over it with a large pipe up to the ship, is probably the earliest going to be Wednesday, probably later on in the week. And another thing, too, the hurricane season starts tomorrow, and if this procedure is in place, they admit it's not going to catch all the oil, and it's going to have to be suspended in the event of a hurricane. So the ship is going to have to pick everything up out of the way, move to a safe harbor, wait the hurricane out, and then come back on station. I mean, it could be 5-7 days, and all that time the oil is just going to spew out unabated. I mean, this is bad news. The only thing that's going to stop it, as we've discussed, is the drilling of the relief wells, which won't happen until August.
Yeah, they won't be ready. It'll
that's
be
right.
So wake up months.
And, George, I got a big news for the Coast listeners tonight that I'd like to pass on.
Please, go ahead.
The Coast Guard and the Mineral Management Service have been conducting joint hearings down in Louisiana. I've been following this. Now, the Deepwater Horizon rig was a foreign flag rig, as you know, registered in the Marshall Islands. And as such, it was subject to international safety regulations. It was revealed in the hearing that critical emergency equipment on board that rig had not been maintained or inspected for over 6 months before the explosions came. And in some cases, it was more than 6 months overdue.
Somebody's doctored some documents there, Kelly.
This is bad news, George. And if you know, if this had been a U.S. flag rig, the Coast Guard would, in my opinion, would have had them shut down, and this disaster would have never occurred. And that's why a lot of people, a lot of mariners, including myself, feel that any rig that's drilling for oil in our territorial waters should be registered in the United States, subject to U.S. Coast Guard inspections, and our more stringent operating requirements that our laws require.
All right, Kelly, keep in touch. In a moment, David Bloom will join us for the entire hour as we talk about the spill in the Gulf of Mexico. In the news, a story at coasttocoastam.com. This hole, I think, would make Mel's Hole look small. You've got to see the picture of this. At least 115 people have died after a tropical storm battered Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador over the weekend. Guatemala was the hardest hit, with at least 92 deaths, 54 people missing, 59 injured. Nearly 112,000 people have been evacuated, and more than 29,000 are living in temporary shelters. What a disaster there. The devastation has been widespread throughout Guatemala, with mudslides destroying homes and buildings and burying some victims. At least 9 rivers have dramatically popped up to higher levels, and 13 bridges have already collapsed there. In the northern part of Guatemala City, the downpour created a giant sinkhole. There's a picture at coasttocoastam.com in the news where you can see an aerial version of this hole. It is unbelievable how deep it goes. It swallowed up a space larger than the area of a street intersection. Residents say that a 3-story building and a house fell into the hole, simply swallowed up. A U.S. cage fighter apparently ripped out the heart of his training partner while he was still alive after becoming convinced that he was possessed by the devil. Jared Wyatt also cut out Taylor Powell's tongue and ripped off most of his face in a brutal assault that police said looked like the scene from a horror film. They claim that they found the 26-year-old man standing naked over his friend's body, holding parts in an eyeball in Klamath, California. Wyatt apparently told police that he had a cup of mushroom tea and then felt that his friend was possessed. A 21-year-old musician has survived a fall from a New York City balcony. While he hit his head, it became impaled on a spiked metal fence. Police say that Nicholas Blossom was intoxicated at a party in Manhattan's Chelsea neighborhood when he fell from a 3rd-floor balcony. They say he landed headfirst on the fence of the 2nd-floor balcony of an adjoining building. Rescuers used an electric saw to detach him from the fence. He was taken to a hospital where he is in stable condition. American scientists say they've developed a vaccine which they say has prevented breast cancer from developing in mice. The researchers, whose findings are published in the journal Nature Medicine, are now planning to conduct trials of the drug in humans, but they warn that it could be years before the vaccine is widely available. They say that death goes in threes, and I guess you could say that again and again. Over the weekend, different stroke star and former child actor Gary Coleman died at the age of 42 after suffering a brain hemorrhage. Mr. Coleman was taken to a hospital after a fall at his home in Utah. Gary Coleman played Arnold Jackson in Different Strokes from 1978 to 86, coining that catchphrase, "What you talking about, Willis?
What you talking about? What you talking about? What you talking about, Willis?"
Gary Coleman, dead at the age of 42. Then actor Dennis Hopper. He's dead at the age of 74, following a battle with prostate cancer. His acting career included Rebel Without a Cause, Blue Velvet, Apocalypse Now, and he wrote and directed Easy Rider with Peter Fonda and Jack Nicholson.
I'm the guy who didn't want Jack in Easy Rider. All right? You're looking at the schmuck right here, okay? I went into Schneider. Schneider said, you got to use Jack. I went in the office and I said, I can't use him. He's not right for the part. And Bert said, listen, I've asked you for absolutely nothing. You're running wild out there. Use Nicholson. I said, okay, but you're screwing up my movie.
Dennis Hopper, dead at the age of 74. And of course, this Memorial Day, let us not forget our fallen soldiers, those who give up their lives to protect you. He was getting old and punchy, and his hair was falling fast, and he sat around the Legion telling stories of the past, of a war that he had fought in, and the deeds that he had done, and his exploits with his buddies. They were heroes, everyone. And though sometimes to his neighbors his tales became a joke, all his buddies listened, for they knew whereof he spoke. But we'll hear his tales no longer, for old Bob has passed away, and the world's a little poor, for a soldier died today. And yeah, no, he won't be mourned by many, just his children and his wife, for he lived an ordinary, very quiet sort of life. He held a job, he raised a family, quietly going on his way, and the world won't note his passing, though a soldier died today. You know, when politicians leave this earth, their bodies lie in state, while thousands note their passing and proclaim that they were great. Papers tell of their life stories from the time that they were young. The passing of a soldier, it goes unnoticed and unsung. The politician's stipend and the style in which he lives are sometimes disproportionate to the services that he gives. While the ordinary soldier who offered up his all is paid off with a medal, and perhaps a pension, small, so it's easy to forget them, for it was so long ago that our Bobs and Jims and Johnnies and Jessicas went to battle, but we know. It was not the politicians with their compromise employees who won for us the freedom that our country now enjoys. Now, should you find yourself in danger with your enemies at hand, would you really want some cop-out with his ever-waffling stand? Or would you want a soldier who has sworn to defend his home, his kin, his country, and fight until the end? It was just a common soldier, and his ranks are growing thin, but his presence should remind us that we may need his like again. When his countries are in conflict, then we find the soldier's part is to clean up all the troubles that the politicians start. If we cannot do him honor while he's here to hear the praise, then at least let's give him homage at the ending of his days. Perhaps just a simple headline in the paper that might say, our country is in mourning for a soldier died today. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie. David Bloom, the executive director of the International Institute for Ecological Agriculture and the author of Alcohol Can Be a Gas. He's the leading advocate for alcohol fuel and the role of the American farmer in developing a truly sustainable energy and food policy for the post-oil era. Here he is this hour on Coast to Coast. David, welcome back, my friend. How are you?
I'm doing great, George. Glad to hear from you.
You too. Well, here we are going into this situation again. They can't control this this incredible leak. What are we going to do, David?
Well, heck, I have some ideas about what we can do, but geez, you know, what they're trying to do is kind of beyond comprehension. I mean, we're talking about, you know, basically 26,000 pounds per square inch pressure coming out of a 21-inch pipe. Some people say it's a little less, but, you know, you imagine a mile of water and 4 miles of rock pressing down on this big balloon of oil and natural gas, and then you drill into it, and what do you expect to happen? You know, it's kind of like, you know, being out there on Memorial Day, having a few too many beers, and you get out the drill and go at your propane tank, you know, and nothing happens for about 5 minutes until you go through, you know.
And then look out.
And then try to stop that leak with mud, right?
You know? Well, you know, I bought a few months ago one of these long faucet stems, right? And you hook it up to your hose.
Yeah.
And it really makes the pressure come out. I can only imagine what it's like down there now, 5,000 feet.
Well, you know, with just a few thousand pounds per square inch, which is the steam that's on nuclear, you know, battleships and stuff. I had a buddy who was a plumber on that, and he said, if you ever hear a steam leak, everybody freezes. And they slide in on the floor a bunch of brooms, and everybody carefully picks one up, and then they wave it in front of themselves down once, and across once, because the pressure is so great, you can't even see the steam leak. And that when somebody's broom gets cut off, that's how they know where the steam leak is.
David, so, in theory, in theory, if they have tapped into an oil reserve down there that may be endless, if they can't cap this, if they can't stop this, this thing could go on until the end of time, couldn't it?
Well, I don't think the end of time, George, because, you know, I think...
How about the end of our time?
Well, maybe not that long, you know, because I expect to be around a long time. And of course, I have solutions that'll keep us around for at least 4.5 billion years. And then the sun burns out and then we have other problems. But,
yeah.
You know, but I think this could go on for months and months and months without any real solution, because really we're actually witnessing the human race being at the edge of its ability to engineer. We're talking about things that only work if everything goes just right. And when something goes wrong, we haven't engineered for what goes wrong yet, because it's never happened before now. This is the first really deep well in the United States. And now we're seeing what happens when we go that deep to get at oil, because, you know, quite frankly, the easy to get at oil is pretty much gone or being tapped already. So now we're going for the stuff that's harder to get at. And there might be a whole lot down there, but the risk of getting it, we're starting to see what that's like. And of course, it's the wrong stuff anyway. But the idea is that, you know, I think it's been said by many wiser people than I that, you know, our ability to engineer doesn't keep us up with our ability to understand the consequences. And so we're at a place now where we've got, you know, questions where, you know, the government says, okay, you know, what's the chance of a blowout down there? And BP says, oh, it's very unlikely, in quotes. And so we have a couple of oil politicians in charge of the government in the last administration that says, well, you know, since more safety would cost a lot of money, like $500,000, you know, for an in-the-well blowout preventer, we think that's unnecessary. But, of course, $500,000 is less than the amount they gave Mary Landrieu down there in Louisiana for her last election. So she still thinks drilling in the Gulf's a great idea.
Well, now they're saying that... assuming that these caps don't work, let's hope they do, that they won't be able to get those relief wells punched in there until August. Is there any guarantee those are going to work, David?
Well, let's see, George. They blew one well, and now we're saying go ahead and drill two more.
Yeah, so now we'll have three spewing oil.
Oh, but there's already two, George. That's the thing. That's what's going on that makes this such a mess, because there have been a few little reports that have leaked out that I've been looking into, where whistleblowers have said, oh, if you think this leak's bad, you ought to see the one that's nearby. And then they shut up. And so you start to look at all the facts in the situation. And I have a theory that fits the facts, which doesn't mean it's true, because you can have more than one theory that fits the facts that are in front of you. But why did they pump mud down this well? Because, you know, 26,000 PSI, and you expect mud and rubber balls to stop.
Yeah, not going to happen. And it didn't.
And so why were they doing it? Well, I'll tell you, when the blast happened at the surface and you had this incredible pressure coming up to the surface, and now you have something that's even more pressure, an explosion that goes at many, many thousands of feet per second, my figure is that it sent down a shockwave down into the well, which is only natural because that's where the site of the explosion was, right at the end of it.
Sure.
And somewhere along that casing, you know, the steel pipe in the ground, below the water, in the ground that goes 4 miles into the earth, somewhere that casing ruptured. And so when the riser coming up from the ocean floor to the rig fell over with the rig and kinked, that's creating thousands of pounds of back pressure. And so the oil is not all coming to the surface at the well. It's going out through the side of the casing, pushing through rock and coming up from the ocean floor nearby. And it's one of the reasons why BP is, in my opinion, is resisting turning over all of its tapes to Congress, because they've got film of that.
Absolutely. And again, it'll be another case of them holding back evidence and information from us, David. We're going to take this quick break, and then we're going to come right back with your phone calls with David Bloom. I know you're very interested in this subject. It's been going on way too long. David Bloom, our special guest this hour on Coast to Coast AM. We'll be right back. And, you know, last week we reported on the death of Art Linkletter, so I guess you're talking about four notables who have now passed on. Four. Next hour, Barbara Hand Clow joins us as we talk about alchemy of nine dimensions. We're talking about prophecies next hour on Coast to Coast AM. And when we come back, we'll take your phone calls and continue talking with David Bloom about the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. That's next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, where we're with David Bloom. David, when you were on with me some time ago when we talked about your book, Alcohol Can Be a Gas, we talked about the alternative energy sources that are out there. Do you think this tragedy in the Gulf of Mexico is going to slow down any possibilities of drilling in the Gulf on future exploration?
Well, not if it's up to the government. I mean, we're being totally insulted with this six-month moratorium that's being proposed. I mean, they're not going to even finish these relief wells in that amount of time, and they're going to say, well, we want more permits. And they, since the blowout, they were given 27 permits, which don't even require an environmental impact report for drilling in the Gulf. So, you know, let's face it, the government doesn't know what to do about this because, quite frankly, they're the lapdogs of the oil corporations. And I think for the one of the rare times that they're treating the government like, you know, the help. And it's in the press, like when BP said, or when Lisa Jackson said, okay, you can't use this super toxic dispersant, this stuff to make the oil go away anymore. You have 2 days to change to something else. BP said, buzz off, you know, we'll do what we want.
Yeah.
I mean, the arrogance, you know, is something we're not used to seeing in the public, even though we know that, you know, the corporations call the shots. So are we going to see, you know, any change in the drilling practices? Well, I think so, because what we need to do, and I see this every day now, that people are really upset about this. I can't count the number of people I've talked to about this, like on the street or in airports, and they start crying about, you know, the devastation, the cataclysm that this represents. I was talking to people today, and I just came from, and here's why I think we're going to be okay on this, is I just came from North Carolina this morning where I was visiting some of my students who, you know, have read my book, mm-hmm. Alcohol Can Be a Gas. And Carl is out there. Now, this is the mountains of North Carolina. I mean, he chews tobacco. He's American as you can get. And after you and I went on the air over a year ago now, where we talked about how the oil companies cut off gasoline to North Carolina and Atlanta and Tennessee, he got really mad and he started looking for information. He built himself a still, just like we talk about in Alcohol Can Be a Gas. So we went out to see his still, and people came from Wisconsin, you know, our friends Kelly and Beth and all that, who are trying to get a driver-owned station going up there. These people are fired up and they are taking action. It's like they know no one is coming to save us.
You
know,
you got that right.
And so it's up to us. And, you know, so here's Carl out there building a still, and all these guys come out of the woodwork from North Carolina where, well, they have a few stills here and there. And, you know, giving them all their, you know, sage advice from generations of moonshining. But he's showing them, putting it in their car and running on it. And they said, well, that's like the kind of stuff we sell, the good stuff we keep and drink, you know. But that kind of stuff you put in the car, yeah, that'll work just great. And it does, of course. And so what we're talking about is really thousands and thousands of people saying no to BP. And, you know, not just BP, but olive oil. Because, you know, as much as I'm not a big fan of the government all the time, I do tend to root for the underdog. And when it comes to oil corporations and the government is the underdog.
You got that right. Let's go to some calls. East of the Rockies, Jim in Gulfport, Mississippi. Go ahead, Gulf. Jimmy, go ahead.
Good morning.
Morning.
I'm listening to Mr. Bloom, and I tell you what, he's right on target. I'm right down here on the Gulf of Mississippi, and I want to say one thing straight up to all you people around the country that are listening right now. Our beaches are open. Our beaches are clean. You want to go deep sea fishing, we got that. You want to go to the islands, it's not hit us yet. But the poor folks over in Louisiana, I don't know why it is, George, but every time I got a heavy heart, I can get through to this program.
Well, you know what? It's called fate. Jim?
I don't know what it's called, but the last time I called, I had a heavy heart about the middle class of America, and now I just feel so bad about my neighbors in Louisiana. Boone just mentioned something about grown men crying. I've seen men over there, now that I can see again, that is, that these are hard men, and they work hard for a living on the Gulf. And the tears come to their eyes.
They've been hit. They got hit by Katrina, and now they fought back, and now they're getting hit again.
And the oil, I don't understand how this worked with the Gulf Current, but it went west. It went north and then west, and now it's into the marshes, and that's where your shrimp come from. That's where your speckled trout come from, your flounder. Everything hibernates out of their marshes, and the marshes are got oil in them.
And let me ask David this, and Jim, very perspective. The perspective that you are bringing us is right on. Let me ask you this, David. You know, the oil that's out there in the marshes, if it's not cleaned up, how long will it stay there? I mean, forever?
Well, luckily not forever, because biology is very clever about breaking things down. And there's all kind of bacteria that live in the soil that will actually do a pretty good job breaking down this oil over maybe 10 years.
Okay.
But that's a long time.
That is a long time.
It only takes 2 drops of oil on one of these birds' eggs out there nesting in the marsh to kill the chick inside, because eggs have to breathe, because air has to get through, and so the lightweight chemicals like benzene and toluene and stuff go right through the egg and kill what's in it. And you're talking about the hardworking men and women in the Gulf. I mean, these folks look at the ocean like a farmer looks at land. I mean, they love it, so when you're talking about this kind of rain of death in the water killing all the life in the Gulf, it's like taking a farmer's land away. It's like the worst thing possible that could happen. And, these people bring $2 billion worth of seafood to the rest of us in this country every year. And BP's telling them, well, we'll give you a few thousand dollars to sit out the season. Mm. Or you can go out there in the middle of the toxic chemicals without a suit, and you can pull booms for us. And now, just today, a bunch of those fishermen had to sue to try to restrain BP from using that dispersant, because they're all coming down with all kinds of neurological symptoms,
absolutely.
Lungs and everything.
Burning eyes, everything.
Yeah. So, we'll go ahead and give you a few $1,000 and a little work out there swimming in our toxic waste.
Let's go to Queens, New York. Bob's waiting for us in the wild card line. Hey, Bob, go ahead.
Hi, George. Great show as usual. I've never been so mad in my life. Have you heard about Kevin Costner's Ocean Machine?
Yes, sure have.
All right. I call these bums every day. I say, are they using his machine? And they say, I never get an answer. Do you know that machine can take, at the rate of 200 gallons, it can turn one, he had one 2.5 tons, and there were 300 of them, and it can take the rate of 200 gallons a minute and turn the oil back into water.
He spent
now,
what
is going? Billy Baldwin was on the television show the other night. Now, George, I got to hear him, but he's got a battery to last 15 years. This is maybe a crazy theory, but I feel like if this technology gets out, that other technology might get out, and I don't know. It's crazy. I mean, they keep hiding technology, and I don't understand.
David, why aren't they using it? Why aren't they using it?
Well, it'll work on a spill. But, George, this is not a spill. This is a freaking geyser.
And a geyser.
We're talking right now, my calculations in pounds, because pounds are what count, over 1 billion pounds of oil and at least that much natural gas have been released so far. Now, you try to, at 200 gallons a time, you try to get out 1 billion pounds of oil. It's going to take a lot of those machines. Now, there are machines that are good at taking the oil off the surface. The Saudis have invented them. They, they don't want the Red Sea to get trashed, et cetera. And so they've got these really great skimmers, but you don't use dispersants with skimmers. You only use dispersants when you want to hide the oil. You make it sink, with the dispersants. But the problem with all this is, no one's accountable, because if it's on the surface, you can see it and clean it up and put it somewhere. So Kevin's machine or the Saudi machine would work on surface oil. But, what's that? Tony Hayward, the guy from BP, which we're calling bloody polluters nowadays, at least one of the names for him. He says, there's a lot of water in the Gulf, and all this oil just, is such a small amount compared to all that water. And I was talking to Silas Bulldog over at Greenpeace. He said, well, Tony, let me spit in your soup and let's see if you still want it,
All right, next up, Josie in Richmond, Virginia on the wild card line. Hi, Josie.
Hello, you all. I want to make a quick question or suggestion, and that is at the top of the hour, when, you know, you've gone to the top of the hour non-programming, that everybody concentrate the light of God over that, and it will be in God's will, over that waterway, and see if something will come in a miraculous fashion. It can be in the form of a whirlwind, a hurricane to chew it all up, or it can be in the form of engineers with some bright ideas that'll work. And what I wanted to tell you right now, too, is I have a news tip, because nobody has yet described how many people were on those flotillas. There are 11 Americans. I know two of the 11 Americans. One of them is an ambassador, Ambassador Ed Peck. He has been let go. But the Liberty survivor who was on the ship, they put him in incarceration in an Israeli jail. And, boy, it should be interesting when they have a tale to tell.
Well, in that situation, too, could get out of hand, because Turkey is sending a number of security ships guarding another flotilla. We're going to talk more about that tomorrow. Let's go to Spokane, Washington, west of the Rockies. David, go ahead.
Yes, I'd like to tell our guests about two interesting points. There's a group of people that want to promote a solution that is the solution to all our energy problems, and they tend to say that we can solve all our energy problems by building all these nuclear power plants. We don't need oil.
That sounds good, but there's a couple problems with that. First of all, nuclear power plants don't run cars. We need liquid fuel for that. So our replacement for oil has to be something that runs the 1.5 billion cars we have out there today. Maybe someday there's electric cars,
yeah,
you know, that could use electricity, but there's a lot better ways to make electricity than nuclear power. Because if you want to talk about a mess, nuclear power makes bigger messes than everything else. I mean, we got Chernobyl, we got Three Mile Island,
yeah,
and we got Chelyabinsk, which you don't know about, because the CIA didn't want Americans to be afraid of nuclear power back in the 50s and 60s. And they buried the waste in Russia, lost track of how close everything was to each other, and the whole bunch went up in a gigantic steam explosion from all the heat and contaminated 100 square miles of Russia where nothing lives. And it keeps spreading because radiation is forever. So, you know, as much as you might think that nuclear power would be some kind of solution, the uranium is owned by the same people that own the oil companies, and we don't need any of this stuff. What we need is you and your neighbors to go out there and make your own alcohol fuel, run your car on it and stop buying oil, and then run your generator on it and stop paying money to the utility companies. That's how we win this thing. We don't go for another magic bullet, big time solution that has all the kind of waste that nobody knows what to do with.
Would blowing it up, not with a nuke, but simply blowing it up, stop it, or would that create even a bigger problem?
26,000 PSI, George. I think what happens is somewhere down there, mile four or something, there's an impermeable layer that the oil was not able to get through. And we drilled through that. So if you blow it up near the surface somewhere, you know, even 1,000 feet down, that's going to seal the top of it, and now it's going to, but now it can get up above that permeable layer, and it's going to work its way through all the cracks in the rock, and it's going to coming up off the ocean floor, like we're pretty sure is already happening.
How did they know where to drill?
Well, you know, I don't know about this particular well, but someone asked me that today, and I'm going to say that the way they usually find out where to drill is they use explosives to set off a shock wave through the rock. And then they use a sensor to measure the speed that the shockwave goes through the rock. And when it hits liquid, it goes faster. So with a few explosions, they can actually map the geology of an area and find the oil that way. And, you know, it's not totally precise, but it gives them a pretty good idea where it is. And that's what they do on land, and I'm pretty sure they would do the same under the ocean.
It's almost like just piercing the planet, David.
Yeah, it's... You know, it's kind of like BP might
be weird.
Bleeding planet, you know, that's another use of the word BP, you know, and, you know, these bloody pirates have been at this a long time. And what we're looking at is, you know, people who are, to use another phrase, you know, beyond prosecution. These guys are so big that when this kind of problem happens, they don't expect to pay the bills. They expect to leave everybody else with it. Look what the Exxon Valdez did. I mean, this geyser is making an exon Valdez every 2.5 days. And it took them 4 summers to clean up the mess in Alaska at $2 billion cost. And they only got like, 5 or 10% of the oil cleaned up. So the rest of it was on the floor of the Gulf of up there in Valdez, and you couldn't fish for years because the stuff is so poisonous. It goes right up the food chain, and we don't want to be eating any of that stuff.
Is there nothing they can do to just soak it up in the meantime? Grass, something? Will anything suck that up?
Well, there's a lot of things you can do to try to help, the thing that's going to, that's doing it already, of course, is bacteria. They'll eventually eat all this oil, but it's a big mess until then. And when the hurricanes come, we can all think about what happens when it hits the fan, but this is literally the oil flying through the air during hurricanes into our coastal towns and cities and covering the earth. This is not a minor disaster.
No.
And the evaporative stuff that's coming off the surface, the really lightweight stuff that's really toxic. Like I say, I was talking to people in the Keys that came from the Keys in Florida, and they're saying it's raining benzene there. In other words, with the rain coming down, it's coming down all the light stuff that's evaporating off the oil.
It's picking it right up. Santa Clarita, California, first-time caller. Let's try to squeeze you in here. Todd, go ahead.
Just a quick few points. One, could this be, orchestrated to push us towards, these alternative energies they keep talking about? And, can you address maybe the cleanup, the recovery of this? Is it possible that we can, use this? We're so dependent on oil. And the other thing,
All right. Do they use this stuff once they scoop it up, David?
Yeah, it's toxic waste. It's out and around, it's toxic waste. Now, of course, BP would like to somehow put their little top hat over this thing and try to get some of that oil because it's worth millions and millions of dollars a day. But once it's out in the environment like this, it's simply toxic waste. And they're already finding dumpsters full of hazmat suits and everything down there. These guys who are working their butt off to try to clean this up, it's like the mess just keeps spreading. And the thing is, only 7% of our oil comes from drilling offshore.
Do you think these engineers ever quietly got together and said, what the heck do we do if something happens and we can't cap these things? Do they ever talk about that?
I'm sure they do, and I'm sure they're all saying, I've got kids to put through college, and I'm not going to bring it up if you won't bring it up. And, the bosses keep doing what they need to do. There were guys on that rig who were reporting to the BP boss that, hey, this well's coming in, the pressure's going up too fast. And the BP boss said, don't put any more mud down there, it's too expensive, let's just put water down there.
How many oil rigs are there around this planet, David? There's got to be thousands of them.
Oh, hundreds of thousands, and there's actually over 1,200 deep-sea rigs that have been built in the last few years, so they want to drill a lot of these things. And this is the first really deep one. This is not the last big blowout and spill. Halliburton cemented the one in the East Timor Sea and near Australia, and it blew out. They've had over a dozen blowouts of their cement in the last 10 years.
You mean after they cap them, they blow out?
No, I'm talking about they drill the well, you put a casing in, which is the metal pipe, and then you put concrete around that to seal it. Because otherwise, the oil and gas will go around the pipe and leak out. And so they can't even get the casing right. They've had many blowouts. This is not a one-time deal here.
That's tragic. All right, David, thank you so much for being on the program. I sense you will be back. David Bloom, author of Alcohol Can Be a Gas. That was a separate show, but that's a remarkable book all by itself. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment as we talk about some 2012 prophecies on Coast to Coast AM.